Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and, well, this evening, the views of William Grigg, who many of you in the Northland up in the Spokane area probably haven't heard before, but we like to have William on every Thursday evening. And he was formerly the chief of the reporter for the New American magazine. He's at the present time writing books and doing talk radio, and he has his own blog spot and a great observer of what's going on. We always love to get his thoughts on current events because, ladies and gentlemen, we are at one of the most exciting times in the history of our nation. We're on the verge, I believe, of expanding the war in the Middle East, which most Americans don't want, which the people of the Middle East don't want, but it would appear that we're almost working on some sort of a cosmic timetable that is intent upon plunging America into an ever larger war, not only in Iran, but with the whole Muslim world, which I fear will have terrible consequences here in the United States, not only morally, but it could very well precipitate a real financial crisis here. And then, of course, we bear the responsibility, each of us, for what happens over there, and the more lives will be lost if we don't speak out about what's going on. And so anyway, what are we going to be talking about this evening, William? William, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, go right ahead.
Well, I think that the really dramatic event of the last 24 hours or so was the passage of the defense appropriation measure that contains the hate crimes amendment named after Matthew Shepard. And I think in this you probably have the distilled essence of what we see in terms of the so-called two-party system. You've got the so-called defense appropriations measure. We've not really had a Department of Defense since the Department of Defense was called the War Department, when at least they were candid about the function they were supposed to carry out. One of the functions of a government is to mount a defensive war on behalf of the people that government is supposed to protect. That goes back to the only legitimate function of government being that of defending the rights of innocent people. Back when it was called the War Department, we actually had a military establishment that was largely geared for defense, and now that it's called the Department of Defense, it's involved in anything but defense, as we found out on the morning of September 11th, among other occasions in recent history. But the point is, the Defense Appropriations Bill is intended to promote and entrench these wars abroad and to expand the war eventually to include a conflict with Iran. There was the Kyle Lieberman Amendment, which is an anodyne sense of the Senate resolution, which, at least in terms of its rhetoric, clearly anticipates a war against Iran. And the defense, so-called defense appropriations measure, of, I believe, is configured in such a way as to take that likely scenario into account. And by attaching this so-called hate crimes measure, the federal hate crimes measure, to this bill, you really see the convergence of interests on the part of the Democrats and the Republicans. The Republicans right now are a militaristic party. They support militarism and police state coercion at home. The Democrats support social engineering and the nanny state, both here and abroad. And so this measure now has something for both parties. You've got militarism coupled with radical social engineering. Now, who's the loser in that arrangement? Well, everybody who's not part of this political entente. Everybody who cares about individual liberty and doing something to restore our constitutional order is the loser in this relationship. And I think that's a perfect illustration of how Washington politics works.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment with William Grigg as we analyze what the real forces are behind the new hate crime legislation.
Well, it's interesting that it's named after Matthew Shepard. Matthew Shepard, of course, was this very slight-figured young man from Well, he was not from Wyoming, I don't think, but he was going to school in Laramie, Wyoming, about a decade ago when he was at a bar and he made the acquaintance of a couple of I almost said rough trade specialists. That seems to be what they were interested in. But they took him out, robbed him, and beat him to death. And because Matthew Shepard was a homosexual, it's believed that he was killed for that reason. I'm not sure that that's the case, but in any case, the really important thing here is that a young man was beaten to death, and that's a crime of sufficient magnitude that you really cannot do anything to add another degree of outrage to that offense. You know, somebody who's beaten to death is the victim of murder, and that describes Matthew Shepard. But because he was a homosexual activist, he's been anointed a martyr for the cause of gay rights, the cause of what is called tolerance. And so the measure today was named after Matthew Shepard, which is a way, of course, of framing an issue so as to put critics of the issue in the worst possible light, the assumption being that if you oppose that amendment, you somehow could countenance the premeditated beating of a helpless little boy. And so you end up with this part of the process here, this kabuki theater that we see in Washington, where the issue is framed in a way that puts people who oppose it in a position of having to explain that, no, they do not support crimes of violence committed against anybody. But the problem with the hate crimes law, of course, is that it ventures into a territory that the government really has no proper jurisdiction, and that has to do with personal opinions, values, and motives in terms of, and only in terms of, one's fundamental value judgments. You can make an inquiry into motives in order to understand whether or not somebody is a legitimate suspect of a crime. I mean, if somebody has a clear-cut motive to kill somebody, then he becomes a plausible suspect. But what the state cannot do is say it is improper for somebody to have certain opinions about matters of race or sex or sexuality or religion. That's something government cannot do, is prescribe these attitudes. And that's what a hate crimes bill is intended to do, by associating crimes of violence with certain socially proscribed attitudes. If now you have a situation where the federal government has expanded the protected categories to include what is called sexual orientation, which is another dishonest term of art. I mean, most people are oriented towards sex. Sex, of course, is part of human reproduction, and so we're oriented towards sex, but the way that the phrase sexual orientation is used, it has to do with sexual proclivities, specifically that form of confused sexuality known as homosexuality. Primarily, but it also includes other forms of sexual deviance. That's what we're talking about.
Hold that thought there. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is just saying that really it is not the function of government to try to legislate attitudes. Certainly, I think that hating homosexuals is abhorrent. I think violence against homosexuals is abhorrent. But what it becomes the function of a federal government to legislate how people will feel or their prejudices, why this, of course, gets to the point where every aspect of human endeavor can be regulated, and that's what they really want. The homosexuals, in my estimation, and homosexuality is being used, and the homosexuals are being used, and they're not smart enough to realize this, and unfortunately, this sort of legislation could end up very well doing far more harm to the homosexual and the homosexual movement down the line, because, of course, this is what happens when you have an authoritarian society. And people have forgotten what happened back in the 1930s in Germany, where, of course, the major force behind Adolf Hitler was the homosexuals, the brown shirts, under Ernst Röhm. And then after they had actually obtained political power, and the Führer was in office in Berlin, why came the Night of the Long Knives, and all those homosexual leaders were simply slaughtered in one evening, and the rest of the homosexuals, many of them, were taken off to concentration camps, because once freedom is gone, then no man's freedom is safe, whether it be homosexual or heterosexual. Go right ahead, William.
That's a very important point that many people don't recognize. Adolf Hitler, although in history he's depicted as somebody who is, for lack of a better way of describing it, fundamentalist in his outlook on morality, was actually very latitudinarian about the issue specifically of homosexuality. He, as late as 1931, if I remember correctly, there was a book that came out in the late 80s called The Pink Swastika that went into some, actually it was the early 1990s, the pink swastika, and then there was another one that came out called The Pink Triangle a couple of years earlier that was published by New Republic Books. I actually saw that books in galley when I worked as an intern at the New Republic back in the late 1980s. Both of them, however, documented the same thing, namely that Adolf Hitler, as a matter of his campaign posture regarding matters of morality, said that it made no difference to him whether somebody was what we would now call straight or homosexual. So the question was whether that person was a faithful member of the Nazi Party. And, of course, Ernst Rehm was a homosexual. Most of the brown shirts were homosexuals. Ernst Rehm was also a pederast, meaning that he preyed on young boys. But he was used, Ernst Rehm and his cadres were used in order to consolidate power. They were terrorists. They were street thugs. The very movement that sort of coalesced into the National Socialist Movement, as Eric Ritter von Kleinert-Ledin pointed out in his book, Leftism Revisited, gestated in the homosexual slums of Bohemia. And so once they came to power, the dispensable element of the coalition, the brown shirts, were purged, and that you had a full-blown police state apparatus put into effect that persecuted pretty much everybody except those who, for whatever reason, were the momentary passing favorite of the regime. And one of the things that both the pink swastika and the pink triangle point out was that the concentration camps in which homosexual political prisoners were killed by the Nazis were manned by people who were homosexuals. A lot of the people who were on the delivering end as well as on the receiving end of the murderous persecution of the Nazis were homosexuals. And so it's a question of what the state finds useful, not a question of what the innate value of the individual is. You're exactly right when you talk about the danger here of hate crimes laws in terms of catalyzing government power and then turning it against the public in a way that makes the attitudes, the unspoken beliefs and values of the individual a subject for government scrutiny, and how that's really not to the advantage of anybody, whether that person is straight or what we now call homosexual. I have friends and I have family members who practice that lifestyle. They know that I do not approve, and more importantly, that God does not approve. I mean, God was very clear about that. If you accept the Bible as God's word, as I do, then that opinion is really not optional. I mean, it's very clear in the Bible what sexual morality is approved of by God. And homosexuality is referred to as an abomination, as is adultery, as is fornication, as are a number of other things that don't meet with God's approval. But the thing is, as I've explained to people, there's not a grading curve here. I mean, we're all sinners. If we say we're not sinners, we're liars. The truth is not in us. There's none of us that does good, not one. We're all sinners. We all rely on the same saving grace that is offered to us through Christ. Having that as an understanding as well that each individual, as a result of being created in the image of God, has individual rights, that you can understand the real danger that we're dealing with here, which is a state that would start putting people into scales and weighing their attitudes and weighing their values on the basis of some of the criteria, apart from those which were provided to us by the Constitution and by Christian tradition. And the hate crimes mentality is a repudiation of that tradition, because it elevates the state to the role of God. And in that circumstance, we're all imperiled. And that wheel can turn against homosexuals. I mean, right now you've got homosexual pressure groups who are building up the power of the state, and they don't understand that that same wheel can turn and they can be on the receiving end. And there was a comment that was made by Teddy Kennedy as he promoted this amendment that perfectly illustrates what I'm talking about. I want to quote that statement. At a time when we are fighting terrorism abroad, the United States Senate says we are going to fight terrorism, hatred, and bigotry here at home. What Teddy Kennedy was saying was that the state, the federal government, United States Senate was authorizing the federal government to prosecute a war against politically impermissible attitudes on the part of Americans. These are a species of terrorism. The so-called war on terrorism abroad, of course, involves such things as dropping 2,000-pound bombs on residential neighborhoods, door-to-door, house-to-house searches that involve people being thrown out of their beds face-first the middle of the night. Such things as talk of nuking Iran. I mean, that's deadly serious business. It also involves extraordinary rendition where people are delivered for torture. People are detained in Guantanamo who may or may not have had anything to do with terrorism, but they have no rights. That's the war on terrorism abroad. transpose that into what would happen here at home, and you've got a pretty good idea just how terrifying, how genuinely terrifying that statement by Teddy Kennedy should be. You talk about a hate crimes act as being part of a war on terrorism here at home. That's the wheel turning against the Christian right. And that's something I wish they could understand. They've been happy, most of the Christian right, to abet the metastatic growth of the central government under George W. Bush in the serene and misplaced confidence that these instruments of oppression would never be turned against them. Guess what, people? Today it turned. Now we're talking about targeting the attitude ignorantly and dishonestly called homophobia as a form of terrorism. They're talking about targeting people who promote the idea that there is something innately wrong or sinful or immoral about homosexuality that would be seen as a precursor to a form of a terroristic attitude. What are they going to do about this? Well, they're going to complain that it's horrible and unfair and coercive and oppressive and dictatorial and totalitarian to be talking about churches who preach the Bible that way. And they're exactly right. But you know what? They helped abet this state of affairs by not standing up for the Bill of Rights, by not opposing the accretion of power in Washington, the consolidation of power in the executive, by not speaking out against the embryonic police state that is now pretty much a full-term infant of a police state. They helped set the table, and now they're being dragged there, and I don't think they're going to like what's put before them for their main course.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that this is really a tragic day. One of the great tragedies of this whole thing is there were people in the Senate who said, well, certainly if this passes, why, the president has said he would veto it.
Yeah,
the question
right.
is, you know, will he really veto it? Will he veto the Defense Appropriations Act? And I don't think so for one minute.
No.
In fact, the president had time and time again, refused to use the veto when he should have and used the veto when he shouldn't have. So we're in a real difficult situation. And put the confidence in the president to lay the future of the entire precept of the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights at the hands of President Bush, who, when we had an opportunity to meet him initially, and he was asked whether or not he would sign legislation that was unconstitutional, his response was, I don't understand the question. He said that directly to me. I don't understand the question. And yet we are going to, of course, give him the responsibility to determine whether or not to sign or veto this legislation. I share your concern with him.
Well, not only did he say that he didn't understand the question, which is surprising because it was a question phrased in Bush's native tongue in small, easily understood words, but on one occasion, I believe in 2002, when he signed the McCain-Feingold Act on so-called campaign finance reform, which is nothing more or less than a measure intended to ration political speech so as to protect incumbents from criticism, Mr. Bush admitted that he was signing a measure that was probably unconstitutional on its face. But he said, as he signed this measure, that he hoped that the courts would fix it. In other words, he was admitting that something that he had signed would not pass constitutional muster. And it was written in a way that suggested as much because it had a number of discrete provisions and then a severability clause. The severability clause is an instrument in legislation that means that if a certain part of the legislation is struck down, the rest of it would be considered constitutional unless the Supreme Court or a federal appellate court leading up to the Supreme Court would go through and specifically nullify every element of the bill as unconstitutional. But Bush signed that measure after promising that he would not. That was an explicit campaign promise he made in 2000, if I remember correctly, saying that he would hope that the Supreme Court would fix what he was doing by putting a signature to a facially unconstitutional act. And if I'm not mistaken, he's only cast one veto.
And, of course, but the significant thing was that when it went to the Supreme Court, the McCain-Feingold bill, they said it was constitutional.
Yeah, they upheld almost all of it.
He had signed something he said he believed was unconstitutional, figuring that the Supreme Court would nullify it, and then the Supreme Court didn't nullify it. So he becomes complicit, in my estimation, with a crime, because he had actually sworn that he would uphold the Constitution and defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And yet he specifically went against what he had sworn to do and signed legislation he knew was unconstitutional. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg here. And we're in real trouble, ladies and gentlemen.
But with respect to the issue of the veto of the defense authorization bill, I really don't think we're going to see that. I don't think that the rhetoric about a veto threat is going to last much more than the next 24 or 48 hours.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
On the plenary powers of the president to conduct both foreign and domestic policy as commander-in-chief. And there are no plenary powers of the president. The president is an instrument of the powers assigned to him by the Constitution and an executive of the properly enacted, constitutionally sound laws passed by Congress. He's also a diplomat-in-chief, commander-in-chief of the Army, but subordinate in that role to the Congress, which has, once again, the plenary authority to declare war on behalf of the people, and also the plenary authority to establish uniform regulations for the military. There really are no plenary powers of the president. There's a good reason for that. The people who wrote our Constitution just got through overthrowing a kingdom, if you will. They were part of the British kingdom. They didn't want to be ruled by a monarch, and so they were certainly not going to create a monarchical executive. But David Addington and John C. Yu and people of that kidney seem to think that the president is not only a monarch, but he's in some sense nearly messianic. And so they wanted to do away with the FISA court. They wanted the president to be able to wiretap anybody, anytime he saw fit, for any reason that he thought was suitable, for any length of time that he thought was necessary. And back in, I believe it was 2004, this is a few months before the re-election campaign, or part of the re-election campaign, David Addington was confronted by a Justice Department official who was talking about the FISA court and how it would be better if Congress were to enact some measure that the president could sign that would make it possible for the FISA court to be bypassed. This is January 2005, I think. And what Addington said, bear in mind, this is the guy who's now the chief of staff for Dick Cheney, vice president of the United States. David Addington said, we're just one bombing away from getting rid of that obnoxious court, which seems to me to connote that he was in some sense counting on a terrorist attack, hoping for a terrorist attack, and even working in tandem with terrorists as a way of bringing about a structural change to the federal government of the United States, which is, you know, pretty clearly a form of terrorism. You're either covertly or openly collaborating with terrorists if you're hoping that they will attack our country and thereby bring about a political change that you're looking for. You're a collaborator. A less genteel way of putting that, this guy's a traitor. I mean, morally, I don't know, statutorily he can be considered a traitor, but I'd certainly consider that to be a species of treason morally. But David Addington is one of the creators of this unitary president, or rather, unitary executive doctrine, which holds basically that the powers of the president are illimitable, and that anything the president wants to do is essentially the law by which we will have to live. And so acting under that doctrine, this spurious and completely abhorrent doctrine of the unitary executive, Bush has issued these signing statements. He might use one of these signing statements as a way of placating the evangelical right here with respect to this hate crimes amendment by attaching a signing statement to the measure when he signs into the law, saying that he will not consider this to be a legitimate appurtenance to that bill, or some language to that effect. But the thing is, if you take a look at the way this works out, every element of the Bush administration's campaign to destroy the restraints on executive power, everything they've done to enrich the power of the federal government, to centralize power, to make it unaccountable, is leading up to a situation where in January 2009, assuming we have an election and a transition and transfer of power, when the lizard queen, Hillary Clinton, who's the most likely Democrat nominee, is ready to be inaugurated, she's going to have all of these tools at her disposal, including this newly enacted hate crime measure, that would be used as a method of dealing with her domestic critics. And so you're going to see the wheel turn once again. And the people who have been abetting cheerfully this accumulation of power over the last 5 or 6 years are suddenly going to find that it's not nearly so much fun to be playing defense.
Well, I share your concern. I think we should all be concerned. Whatever the Constitution and the restrictions on the power of the central government comes under attack, why, it means we're losing our freedom. And the great tragedy is today, most people don't understand that the recent hate crime legislation is totally and blatantly unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, can we really depend upon the court that George Bush has appointed, where several of the people there he's appointed, to do what the right thing is? And I really have serious reservations. I think the people, certainly Judge Robertson and the others, other one that was appointed, are there for a specific purpose. And we unfortunately find people at the highest levels of our government who neither understand the Constitution nor support it. They have their own agenda. And, of course, their loyalty is to the structure of government rather than to the freedom of the populace. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, William Greig. William, go right ahead.
I do think that at some point, I don't know how soon it will come, but the point has got to come soon. At some point, it's going to become obvious to people of goodwill that you cannot have the government in the business of scrutinizing what people think and believe. Even when you're talking about types of deeply entrenched hostility that we would have to call prejudice or bigotry, much less if you're dealing with people who espouse religious opinions that are, for whatever reason, momentarily unpopular. I mean, it's not a particularly popular thing anymore to say that homosexuality is an offense to God, because we have been conditioned deliberately for the last 25 years or so into thinking that homosexuality is, if anything, a refinement of common humanity. I mean, right now, if you are foolish enough to sample the depraved product which issues forth from Hollywood, New York, that is marketed under the misleading label of entertainment, you'd be led to believe that homosexuals are like most people, it's just they're a little bit more refined, better educated, and wiser than the rest of us. You know, there's a type of beatification of that lifestyle and the people who practice it in most films. A really good example of this, very, very quickly, is an otherwise really good movie called Blast from the Past that came out about a decade ago. And the premise was that on the evening that John F. Kennedy gave his Cuban Missile Crisis speech, there was an eccentric genius in California who had built a fallout shelter in his basement, who decided that now was the time to go there and wait for the crisis to pass. And while they're down there, a fighter jet crashes on the home, and they're locked in this fallout shelter for, if I remember correctly, 35 years. And the wife was pregnant at the time, so they raised a child in hermetic isolation from the rest of the world. And they emerged in 1998 to a country that had pretty much been ravaged by something even worse than nuclear war. It had been ravaged by the Gramscian Cultural Revolution. You know, when the father ventured forth into this brave new world, he was astonished to find what had happened to his country. He retreated back to the safety of his redoubt, and he was telling his wife and now adult child, it's so much worse than I'd imagined it would be. And so the rest of the story is a picaresque fish-out-of-water tale involving this young man who was a throwback to a more cultivated and genteel period of our cultural history. He was respectful and deferential to women. He was polite. He spoke in complete sentences. He knew how to dance. He wasn't merely engaging in spastic gyrations.
Well, all that thought, we'll be back here in just a moment with William Greig. Well, this is Dr. Stan. William, before we go on, certainly I want you to tell the rest of the story, but right now, of course, I want you to get out your blog site and tell our listeners where they can get the information that that you have, which I think is so very important for people to be able to acquire.
I do appreciate that, Dr. Stan. The easiest way to see what I have to say, what I have to write, is to go to The Right Source, which is a web portal for news and commentary. It's at www.rightsourceonline.com. It's just one word, rightsourceonline.com. Not the right source, just rightsourceonline.com. If you look at your screen, look at the left-hand side of the screen, scroll down about a third of the way, and you'll find my picture. And next to my picture are two hot links that will take you to publications that we put out. The furthest one to the right will take you to my blog, my daily blog, which is entitled Pro Libertate. That's a Latin phrase. It means for freedom. There's also a dormant but still interesting publication, an e-zine or a web magazine called Pro Libertate. That's the link on the left-hand side of that little box in the space next to my photograph. But go to the one furthest on the right. It'll take you to the blog. It's updated between 4 and 6 times a week. Quite frequently, it is republished on the Lou Rockwell website, lourockwell.com. But that's where you can go to see when it's freshest. You can also set yourself up for an RSS syndication feed to be alerted when I've updated the blog. I have a book which will be out, I'm hoping, next week. The cover art is in the hands of the printer. The printing presses are going to start running. The book is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. It's about 330 pages, I think. It ended up being far bigger than I expected it to. Hopefully that'll be available next week. As I said, the cover art shipped out today, And if I'm not mistaken, they're going to be running the presses over the weekend, and the first copy should be available next week, and I'll let you know, Dr. Stan, as soon as they are.
All right, fine. We'll want to get one, and I'm sure we'll do everything we can to help you get it out, because I think it's so important for people to understand that we are moving rapidly towards a police state in what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. Well, during the time we were off, William was telling the story about a movie, and I remember seeing that movie about a couple that built a bomb shelter and went down into it, and of course the plane had crashed on the top of the bomb shelter, so they lived underground for 35 years, and then they came out, you know, of their shelter, having remembered what life was like in the 1960s to the modern day world. And of course they had a son at that time, and of course he has been very properly brought up in every way, and suddenly he is seeing this whole culture out here that he has no grasp of. It's entirely different. It's depraved. There's no such thing as modesty. We're living in truly a hedonistic society. So pick up the story there, William, because it was a fascinating motion picture.
Yeah, it was. It was very well done and very affecting. For instance, there was a scene where this couple is raising their child. They're, of course, homeschooling them. The necessity, they can't get out because their fallout shelter has an automatic lock that wouldn't open for 35 years on the assumption that that would be a sufficient amount of time for the radioactive cloud to dissipate. And so they had to raise the child to adulthood. He was entirely homeschooled. There's one beautiful scene in that film where the mother, who's played, I think, by Sissy Spacek, was teaching her then 10 or 11-year-old son how to dance. And while they're doing that, the father cuts in and shows how a gentleman would do this. And it's just so fascinating to look at the young kid's face as he's seeing how the mother and father love, respect, and trust each other. It's a very moving scene, very powerful. And so when he emerges into this dystopian world that was the United States circa 1998, he was amazed to see that people had apparently completely lost the ability for treating each other with respect and decency. And there is a beautiful scene in the film where he's in a baseball card memorabilia shop, and the proprietor is in the process of firing the hired help, and in the course of doing so, he uses a profanity where he takes the Lord's name in vain. And the young man, 35-year-old man, played by Brendan Fraser, says, "Forgive me, I would prefer that you not use the Lord's name in vain." He's very insistent about it. He says, "Well, you want to talk about something that really throws into sharp relief what's happened to our culture? There's a really good example of that." But the one really pronounced flaw in this movie that makes the point that the screenplay, ironically enough, was making, and I think this is probably something that was done at the insistence of the studio, was that the young lady who is the love interest for Adam in this movie has a best friend who's a homosexual, and he's there primarily to dispense these nuggets of numinous wisdom at various points in the film. And that, I think, is almost a matter of something like law in Hollywood now. You have to have that type of a character in every movie in order to reiterate and reinforce on the mind of the film-going public that these people are just a little bit better than us. They're saintly. They're a source of wisdom. They tend to elevate our culture and so forth. And it's true that many people who have chosen to define themselves by that vice, or who have suffered and had that vice and not made a fetish out of it, have been very talented people. But I prefer to think of them in terms of their talent and not in terms of their character flaws. But the thing is, the idea is that if you love me, you have to love my vice. And if you dare to say that it's a vice, now it's considered a species of hate crime. It'll be tabulated as such. It'll be treated as such. And we've gotten into the realm where the government is in the business of policing attitudes. The federal government now, as of today, is going to be treating this as a branch of the war on terrorism, according to Ted Kennedy, who is one of the chief sponsors of this bill.
Well, of course, Ted Kennedy is such a depraved individual, you can understand why
he
would be pushing.
He's the moral barometer of our republic, isn't
right.
he? But it is always thus. It is ever thus. If you believe that the path to sanctity runs through the consolidation of power in government, you're going to end up putting power in the hands of people who are spectacularly depraved, and Ted Kennedy certainly meets that description. I don't know if he was always that way. I'd like to think that at some point he was somebody who may have been a fundamentally decent person, but I think power plus impunity plus celebrity equals something that looks an awful lot like Ted Kennedy. He's sort of like the portrait of Dorian Gray of every superficially charismatic politician you'd ever run into.
Well, you know, I think the thing that tells us most about what's going on in America today is to examine the man that the Bush family picked to be the outstanding citizen of the year for the year 2003. And the Bush family has a foundation, and every year they pick the outstanding, you know, a gentleman, a politician, leader, to the man of the year or something of that type of award. And in the year 2003, and any of our listeners who are skeptical can check this out on the Internet, and we'll provide the information for them. In the year 2003, the Bush Family Foundation, George Herbert Walker Bush, Jeb Bush, George W. Bush, picked none other than that famous senator from Massachusetts, Ted Kennedy, as the man of the year. Now, why would a Republican family pick Ted Kennedy, you know, as their man of the year for the year 2003 to receive the award of their foundation? And I would like to suggest there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Republican leadership and the Democratic leadership. It's all simply a game to confuse the American people and really believe when they go to the polls that they're voting for the candidate of their choice. And the truth of the matter is, the candidates have already been picked for them, and it doesn't matter which one loses. Why the establishment always wins.
Yeah, that's a very good illustration of that principle, and I hadn't been aware of that, but it certainly figures. Another good illustration of that is the fact that the elder Bush, and this is something I find really interesting, the elder Bush and his wife Barbara have all but adopted Bill Clinton as a surrogate son. Which I find really interesting for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the fact that the Clintons and Bushes are supposedly daggers drawn with each other. But over the last 4 or 5 years, you've seen on many occasions the spectacle of George Bush the Elder, and sometimes Bush the Elder and Bush the Younger together with Bill Clinton, in a setting of great conviviality where it's clear that not only are they part of the same peerage, if you will, as presidents or ex-presidents, but rather they really enjoy each other's company, that they're earnestly enjoying a sense of fellowship and comradeship that transcends mere politics. And now we just saw a couple of days ago where a piece in the Washington Examiner, which is the most recent neocon publication, I think it's the Washington analog of the New York Sun, which is a hardcore neoconservative, meaning Trotskyite newspaper, very much pro-Bush, pro-war on terror, and so forth. They had a piece by Bill Salmon, who just recently did a biography of Bush, where he talks about the fact that George W. Bush is making it pretty clear that he considers Hillary Clinton to be his successor, and so you're at a point now where they're playing this weird, there's this weird square dance routine going on where you've got these interchangeable dynasties now. I mean, who would have thought that you'd have a dynasty where the estranged and cuckolded wife of Bill Clinton would end up becoming his dynastic heir? I don't know if that will go on much longer because they made the mistake of having only one child. I mean, if you want to have a dynasty, you want to have a number to choose from. That was the situation with George Bush and his wife Barbara. Unfortunately, they ended up with George W. rather than Jeb. Jeb had been their first choice. He's a little bit smarter than George W. But then again, you know, your typical your typical louse ward is just a little smarter than George W. But the thing about the Clinton and Bush dynastic do-say-do here, if you will, is that, as you say, this really illustrates that we don't have a choice. Our choices have been made for us. They've been narrowed down to what the people who want to perpetuate this engine of power would consider to be acceptable. And what's acceptable to them are people of that ilk, the Bushes, the Clintons, the Kennedys, and so forth. You know, not people like, for instance, the Ron Pauls of the world, who actually had a life apart from politics and have done something to make the world a better place rather than expanding the power of government as their vocation and their avocation.
Well, I certainly agree. Anyway, we are in real trouble, I think, here as a nation, because the Christian right is solidly behind the current administration. There is no real leadership within the Christian movement or within the conservative movement in opposition to the one-party system which we've adopted. And this is the great tragedy of our time, other than Ron Paul, who is standing like a beacon of light, you know, in a in a world of darkness, and at least saying the right thing. And I am so pleased that so many of the people on the left, or certainly the rational Democrat wing of the Democratic Party, are rallying behind him. I just wish the conservative Christians would support a man who holds espouses their views and in truth espouses them, rather than saying, oh, he is just all in favor of life, but serves as a president for 6 years and refuses to do anything to save the life of the unborn child.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring up the fact that what Ron Paul is saying is resonating with liberals, and Republican conservatives tend to be giving him the stiff arm. I mean, if you remember this so-called values voter debate that occurred just, I think, last week, a few days ago, Ron Paul, when asked about his personal faith and asked about his values and asked about how he would try to apply his biblical-based Christian faith to politics, was talking about the fact that one of the titles of Jesus Christ is the Prince of Peace. And he talked about the Christian just war doctrine, which is something that had been... It's not strictly speaking something that is scriptural, but it is something that emanates logically from the scriptures. It's the result of exegesis from the scriptures. And it was something that was taught by the church fathers and refined by Aquinas and Augustine, and then refined again by a number of Protestant thinkers, and sort of informed the Peace of Westphalia after the horrible 30 Years' War in 1648. The thing is, as Ron Paul was talking about this Christian tradition, about under what circumstances we go to war, how we fight wars, why we fight wars, the type of tactics we should use, the fact that Christians have for centuries been informed by this long tradition that is rooted in the scriptures and ultimately rooted in the identity of Jesus as the Prince of Peace. He was booed. He was booed by an assembly of conservative Christian Republicans for invoking the irrefutable biblical teachings on the subject of war and peace and what it is that Jesus seeks to accomplish terrestrially, in addition to the salvation that he offers us eternally. It's just an amazing spectacle when somebody can stand before a group of people who want to be known by the name of our Lord, and he would talk about the fact that there is this definable, centuries-old, properly esteemed tradition of just war, and for even mentioning that phrase, he could be treated with derision by the people who profess to be, who want to be known by the name of our Savior. That's a really interesting thing. That illustrates, I think, what you're talking about here in terms of the fact that the Christian right is too wedded to the state, too wedded to power, too much wedded to the personality of George W. Bush as somebody who wields power and invokes the proper nostrums and speaks the proper shibboleths, and because he does so, he's supposed to be looked upon as the Lord's anointed. Well, the thing is, in our republic, the rule of law is the king. That is what we as Christians are called to uphold, is the rule of law is enshrined in our Constitution. So far, in this century, the century which is now 6 years old, there's only been one Christian statesman that our country has been blessed with, and that's Ron Paul, because he understands the role of the Constitution. He's serious about it, and he does his level best, which is quite considerable, to bring his performance as an elected representative into harmony with the Constitution. And the other thing about Ron Paul that I think is really important, and this is something we shouldn't miss, as often as we properly commend the fellow for his consistency and his principle and his courage, he's the first to tell you that it's not about him, that it's not a question of what he brings in terms of his attributes, his personality, his virtues. The fact is, there is still a large constituency in this country for freedom, a large group of people who understand liberty under law, who want to restore our Constitution, and that's a transpartisan movement. That's the most encouraging thing I've seen. I don't know if it's too late for that movement to find traction and do some good, but at least we know, based on the reaction that Ron Paul has received and the fact that it has a real magnetism for the young, that there is some cause for optimism.
And there really are, I believe, many, many people here who still value freedom. Most people know something's wrong. Our job is, of course, to try to explain to them what is wrong and how this fits into this great spiritual battle that's being waged today for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Because if we lose America, then, of course, there's this wonderful philosophy that's existed for almost 2,000 years will become naught. America is the ultimate end of this evolution of thought, and wouldn't be ashamed to lose it on our watch. Our guest has been William Grigg. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Wanted to reiterate how encouraged I am by specifically the role of youth here in the Ron Paul movement. And that's something that really has left a lot of people somewhat disconcerted. They don't understand what it is about this genuinely unassuming 72-year-old man who really doesn't have what you would consider to be classic animal magnetism. He has a certain charisma, but it's the charisma of somebody who is completely over himself. And that's, I think, something we best describe as authenticity. A lot of people understand what it is about this man that is so beguiling to people in their 20s, their late teens, 20s, early 30s, and so forth. And it's exactly what you were describing just before the break, Dr. Stan. That is that there are people who still resonate like tuning forks when somebody is telling the truth about what's going on and properly describing how liberty should be the center of our politics. And Ron Paul does that. He lives what he preaches. And I think the other thing about him that really is attractive to young people is the palpable sense that he is willing to lose in order to stay faithful to his principles. You know, you're dealing with somebody here who actually stands for something tangible and real and isn't merely posing as somebody who stands for something. He's willing to lose on principle rather than win through compromise. What a refreshing thing that is.
Well, that's why, of course, he's known in the House of Representatives as Dr. No, and that most people, of course, would disagree with him. But I doubt that there's anyone, a Democrat or Republican, who doesn't respect Ron Paul because he stands for something. And unfortunately, in the House of Representatives, where you have so many equivocal men, many times the vote will be 434-1. And yet he will stand on the Constitution. And that, of course, is what every member of Congress has sworn to uphold.
Yeah, I think, including the people who despise him, I don't think there's anybody who doesn't respect him.
And so, really, I think we're very, very fortunate. And at this time in history, I really believe God has raised him up for a purpose. I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be a very fascinating time as we move, I fear, towards a war with Iran, a war with the Muslim world, the disruption of the economy of our nation, perhaps even increased acts of terror and violence and civil unrest and resistance to government. And who knows what's going to happen to America? All we can do is do our best, and William is on the front lines of this battle. He does a great job. We enjoy having him every week. I hope that our listeners will always make a point to listen on Thursday evening, and as long as we can get him to come on, we will. Good night. God bless you, William.
God bless. Thank you so much.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoyed our guest, William Grigg. He is certainly one of the most articulate people that we have, former a senior editor of the New American Magazine, and we're just very, very fortunate to have him. Now, if you're listening up there in the Great Northwest, remember, you can get our program on shortwave this time of evening at 9.480 megahertz. That's 9.480 megahertz. You can always hear us on the internet at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. You can listen actually 4 hours a day to live programs, 9 hours a day. on our feed to Telstar 5. And if you want to get an inexpensive satellite where you can hear Al Jazeera and a number of Christian and secular stations in other languages, as well as, of course, Radio Liberty, 24 hours a day. We have a 24-hour feed along with the Power Hour and several other excellent Christian ministries on Telstar 5. And if you want more information, our webpage is radioliberty.com. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We want to again remind you that we are having our all-day seminar on the 28th of October. That's a Sunday, a little over 4 weeks from now. And we do hope that many of you will be coming. And we have a great lineup of speakers. We're going to start early in the morning and go into late in the evening. We'll be serving lunch, so you're going to have a reservation. But if you can make it, I think that you'll enjoy it. And you realize there are a lot of other people from all across the country that feel the way that you do. And we still are a voice out there, a voice of reason in a world gone mad. Now, if you certainly would like, of course, to get a new four-tape set we're just putting together, it's on civil defense. I mean, how do you shelter in place? What should you be thinking about? What preparations should you begin to make? We have a two-hour interview with Wayne LeBaron and other interviews with other experts in this field of civil defense. It's a four-tape or four-CD set, and if you order it, why, it'll take a week or so to put it together, but it's now going to be readily available. We, of course, have the DVD, Sheltering in Place. How would you utilize your home if there were a chemical, biological, nuclear attack? How would you seal your rooms off? Would you seal your rooms off? What would you need? How would you survive? Maybe would you panic and start running around or try to get away? Or would you be prepared? And this is what the DVD Sheltering in Place is all about. We have a great book put out by the military, but of course now available to you. It's called Nuclear War Survival Skills, and if you want to, and you buy the book, of course you can get a packet that shows you how to make a radiation meter, and you can inexpensive. Everything's there but a little tin can that you need to make this meter. We carry the book, Making the Best of Basics. What do you do when you go to the store and there's nothing in the store? What do you do for water? What do you do for food? How do you prepare food? How do you cook food in a society where we do not have all the conveniences we have today? These and so many other things are available at Radio Liberty, but let me suggest the 4-CD or 4-tape set, and we'll get that off to you as soon as they're completed. And then, of course, the book on nuclear war survival skills, and you can get separately a packet for building a radiation meter. Certainly the book, Making the Best of Basics, and of course, the DVD on Sheltering in Place. So many things are available to Radio Liberty. If you'd like to get the potassium iodide or iodate to protect your thyroid in the case of a nuclear attack, all of these things you have to prepare for and hope and pray that they never come to pass. But we are called upon, I believe, of course, to be prepared for difficult times. And I believe, of course, if God is just, he's going to bring terrible judgment on this nation. I believe we're preparing for a war with Iran, and who will be responsible for the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people who die? And, of course, will the Arab world simply sit there and allow it to happen without making retaliations? And they could topple our country financially, literally overnight. So please pray for America and pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, of course, our guest for this hour is Melody Cederstrom. And Melody sells gold and silver coins, and certainly she supports Radio Liberty, and we support her, and we certainly know many people who've dealt with her and been very, very pleased. And how are you doing tonight, Melody? Melody, are you there?
There you are. Now I can hear you.
All right, fine. Well, I just forgot to push one of those buttons there. Anyway, of course, how's everything going with you?
It's great, Dr. Stan, and I want to thank you for having me on the program.
Well, it's always a pleasure, and certainly we see that there's even a little action even today in gold and silver. Gold was up almost $5 today, and silver was up 15 cents or so. That's not a great move, but, you know, when you begin to see gold and silver moving from an already high position to a higher position, it certainly suggests to me that something big is in the offing. We just don't know what it is. We don't know why that canary in the mine shaft is looking so sort of sick and falling over, but we know something's wrong when the canary falls over.
I think there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes, and it's interesting because I believe the major is the dollar, and I do believe there's a lot of countries that are disposing of their dollars. I believe they're coming in and they're buying a lot of the soft commodities like the wheat, the soybeans, and corn. Wheat is selling for, I believe, the last quote I heard was, you know, like $9.30 or something like that.
You mean $9.30 for a bushel of wheat?
Yeah.
Because when it broke $8, that was something monumental.
And some of my farmers believe that it could also be going to $11. We have countries that are in drought that haven't been able to produce wheat. Our country, we're taking out our wheat fields to grow corn for the biofuels. So I believe there's going to be a major shortages in food in the coming years. But it is also a way in which a lot of these countries can replace their dollars. And they're hoarding the foods, the wheat, the soybeans. And it's just another way that they can dispose of the dollars. And in the meantime, creating shortages, which, of course, our country is not prepared to bear, because our storage facilities, they're either bare or very close to being bare. Our growing fields have been so depleted of nutriments, and of it's going to be a tough year next year.
Oh, well, I really think it is. Now, how did the dollar finish? We know that it was down almost to 78 the other day. Where is it? Did you have any idea?
Right now, it's like about 78.20 down 05.05. Even in the aftermarket, we have gold up $4.
To where is it now?
737.20.
All right, fine.
The aftermarket is a thinly traded market, though, so, you know, it can have a little bit of a distortion. But it's interesting to watch these markets, you know, early in the morning, because just like yesterday, the dollar, it looked like it was going to be breaking 78.20. I think it got as low as 78.10 or 78.11, somewhere around there. Gold was up stronger, and they came in yesterday, and they brought the dollar back a little bit, and of course gold was only up a little bit yesterday, but and it was pretty much the same this morning.
Well, of course, what I would like to do, I go to Kitco and I look and see what's happening to Dubai, and that usually sort of gives you an idea maybe what's going to happen, you know, in the next day on the American markets, and certainly they were about 7:40. So, you know, I think that it's not going to be much of a stretch before gold hits 7:50. And what it does, why, I think it's going to have real implications as far as the gold market, and people may begin once again saying, "Hey, maybe there really is some very real value there." Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is Melody Cederstrom, and we're just talking about the dollar. For those of you who do not understand the term and what 78.20 means, basically the dollar was up to about $1.20 or $1.30 or $120 or $130 in reference to a basket of currencies about 3 years ago, and it's gone from that neighborhood, about $130, down to $78, which is actually a drop of almost 50 points. So we're talking almost a 40% drop in the value of the dollar over the last 3 years as far as the international markets are concerned. So if you were sitting over in China holding American dollars, you've lost 35 to 40% of your investment, and you're probably not very happy. In addition, you've bought bundles and oodles of these collateralized debt obligation bonds, which you thought were just as good as the American dollar, and you suddenly find out that they may be only worth 10 or 15 or 20 cents on the dollar that you paid for them. And if you're a Chinese bureaucrat and you are looking, and you know what happens to bureaucrats that make bad investments for the government, and you're wondering how soon you may be up against the wall of the firing squad, I would think that many of the officials in the Chinese government would be looking for ways to divest themselves of American currency and American bonds and American treasury bonds, etc. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree. I mean, we talk about them buying the soft commodities, but with that, I believe they're also buying gold. And someone's in there buying it because I do believe they're trying to keep it from increasing. And this is the point where oftentimes we talk about how they manipulate gold, but eventually the physical buying is going to overtake their ability to suppress the price. And I have a customer. He actually lives in, well, I don't have a customer. He's a listener to the program that we have earlier in the day. And he's lives in Dubai. And he said the gold and silver markets in Dubai are really tight. His email told me yesterday when he started acquiring silver bullion over two years ago, you could have your pick. It was very easy, and they buy a lot of silver bars and gold bars. But he hasn't been able to get silver bars for over a year, only the 1 gram silver bars, and they are also hard to acquire. He also says that the same way with gold. He says they used to purchase 50 to 60 kilograms at a time in large bars, and he hasn't been able to purchase them in months. So he sees the, and he says concerning gold bullion coins, he said as soon as he gets them, they're flying out the door. This is what his supplier tells him. And
Hold that thought, I'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Melody was just telling us that she has certainly one of her clients is over in Dubai. And, of course, as you know, they have their own gold and silver exchange there. There's one in the United States, certainly. There's one in, maybe it's the Chicago the Mercantile Exchange, I'm not certain, but there's a gold exchange in London. There's one in Dubai. Those are the three big ones over throughout the world. And there should be smaller exchanges, but those are the major ones, probably Chicago, London. Is that Chicago or is that would be New York? Do you know?
I would think it's Chicago.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, in Dubai. Well, anyway, Melody was saying this gentleman over in Dubai is saying that he's having real trouble getting both silver and gold in the way of bonds, bars, or even coins. That these things are very tough to get. Is the price out of line, or is it simply that the asset, the physical asset, is very hard to get hold of?
Well, I think it's very hard to get a hold of, and I think we'll see that here in this country. We saw a little bit, a short-term period in August, when we had the stock market fall 1,000 points, and there was significant panic and an urgency in purchasing coins, and product dried up very quickly. And we are now just getting back online to where there's an even flow of coins, and people just don't realize how thin the market will be. And when you have a currency crisis, people will not sell. You will not have an even exchange of buyers and sellers. Of course, when gold gets to a certain price, you will have some people take profits. But, I mean, why? If you have a currency that's losing more and more value, they're just going to hold on to their gold. So I do believe we'll come to a time where product will be limited or not able to be purchased at all.
All right. Well, of course, the thing is that the average person thinks that this just could never happen in America. But certainly the problem we have is we have a fiat money system. And when you look and see what's really happening, you're told by the officials of the Federal Reserve Board, Mr. Bernanke, chairman of the Fed, that we have about a 2.2 or 2.4% inflation rate. And he's simply not telling you the truth. I mean, the inflation rate's probably 10 or 11%. And, of course, but the average American doesn't know. He doesn't certainly read the Federal Reserve statistics. Actually, we are publishing those in our next newsletter, and they're really fascinating. And even though the Fed has refused to now publish the M3, which is the overall amount of money that's out there, not only in the United States, but in other banks and vaults throughout the world. I mean, this figure is running in the neighborhood of about 11% at the present time. And, of course, it's higher than that, about 13%, at least according to Bob Chapman. And if that indeed is the case, we could expect 13 or 14% inflation in a year or two, and it doesn't take very long before that completely destroys the value of the savings and the pensions and the insurance policies and the bonds and the annuities and the CDs of everybody out there in the listening audience who, if they've stayed in the dollar fixed assets, why, they're very foolish, because we know that that certainly Alan Greenspan is not there. When he was asked by Leslie Stahl on a 60-minute interview, which was recorded about a week and a half ago, what he was doing with the $8 billion he received for writing his book, he said that what he was diversifying. He was diversifying, which means he's not putting his money in dollars. He's putting it in, in fixed assets or foreign currencies. And I think that when the man who is the architect of what's going on now tells us that he's diversifying with his own money, we should be doing the same.
Absolutely, we should be diversifying, and gold is a very important factor. And I hear people tell me, well, how much is too much gold? And I don't think anybody can have too much gold when we see what's happening. I mean, we're having a currency crisis. And when you even compare gold with so many of the other investments, when you look at the returns, when you look at the risks that are involved, gold still seems to carry the least amount of risk. And many times I have customers who want to know if there could be a run on the banks like they had over in, you know, with the Northern Bank, and we talked about that it could be a possibility, but the people don't seem to realize that perhaps there could also be a run on Wall Street. If you have a run on Wall Street, I believe that things would get so tied up that getting access will be limited, and also the amount of money that would need to be sent out to the clients in checks. That's another, think we think of the market crashing, but what about the access to the funds that you have in there? And so if you believe that there could be a run on banks, there could also be a run on Wall Street. And I was just talking to a stockbroker today, and he's pulling all his money out, and that's what he was telling me. He says, I don't trust it. And he says, when people begin to panic and they get in there, he says, they're not going to get their money out. And so, you do need to offset and hedge yourself if you have money in the markets. If you don't take it out for whatever reason, at least offset it with gold.
Because my fear is if we have an attack on Iran, that or we should have a major calamity when we were to attack Iran, what would happen if the Iranians simply were to counterattack? What would happen if they were to take out one of our carriers? What do you think would happen to the American stock market? What would happen if they were to simply lob mortars or missiles into the green zone and kill a few thousand Americans? And I would hope and pray this would never, never happen, but think of the implications for America. What would happen, of course, if America should not do well in this war? What would happen then to our stature throughout the rest of the world? Would all the countries rally behind us and protect us? Does every country love America? are more and more countries looking upon the United States as the bully of the world, and of course, as, you know, and maybe perhaps even President Ahmadinejad is a hero. At least he looks a lot more friendly than George W. Bush does in many of the pictures that are shown. So, I mean, certainly, I believe that, of course, we have a very real problem in the world today, but I really believe that the problems we face today can be manifested in the financial affairs of our nation. And for all intents and purposes, we are a bankrupt nation. No one really has to look at the statement by David Walker, who is the CEO, the General Accounting Office, or the man primarily responsible for looking after the budget of America. And I was just reading today, his opinion as of several years ago was that the official debt of America was not almost $9 trillion, as we were told, but was closer to $48 trillion, a substance that could never be repaid. So we are a bankrupt nation morally, we're a bankrupt nation financially, and I really fear that there are going to be terrible consequences coming down the line. So anyway, I think people are going to have to be consolidating their situation, preparing to look after themselves. And what would you do if financial status of the dollar came under attack? If other nations throughout the world began selling the almost $3 trillion that they hold in American currency and getting rid of American currency, come in here and start buying up America, stop buying treasury bills, which would mean that the treasury, our own treasury, would have to begin to monetize the debt, which is running in the neighborhood of $3 billion a day. We're spending $3 billion more than we're taking in. And there's no instance in all history where a nation has spent more than it's taking in, where that nation has survived financially.
Well, tonight the Senate passed, and they sent a bill to President Bush. It was a temporary spending measure to keep the federal government running through November 16th. And the bill was designed to avert government shutdowns that would have begun as early as next Monday. If agencies ran out of money, because it's the first day of the new fiscal year. And also tonight, they did pass the increase. They raised the U.S. credit limit and to $9.815 trillion. And it's the fifth increase that we've had in U.S. credit limits since George Bush took office back in January. And
That's January. What? That's January
2001.
Right,
2001.
And of course, actually, we're almost to $8.9 trillion debt. That's what they admit to, but the real debt is in the neighborhood of $48 trillion. But they're simply not telling the American people the truth. But anybody out there in the listening audience who wants to check out what we're saying, just simple Google in David Walker. GAO. That's the General Accounting Office. He is the Controller General of the General Accounting Office of the United States government. And, of course, I think it's a 14-year term, so he can say the truth. Everybody else is afraid to tell you the truth. He's telling you the truth. We're bankrupt. So Google it, find out if it's true, and then start making your plans accordingly, because you're not going to be able to alter what's going to come down the line. You're not going to be able, and I'm not going to be able, to alter the moral and financial bankruptcy of this nation. But, of course, our job is to survive, and so that one day we can tell others what it was to have lived in this great nation of America when men were free. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is Melody Cedarstrom, and I believe we are in terrible financial problems, and more so now than ever before. We're going to be back in just a moment with Melody as we explore what's going on. Of course, Melody's on the front lines talking with people all the time who are investing in gold and silver and trying to protect themselves. And Melody is seeing a lot more interest here in this last few months or so.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's been a new interest and a lot of new people to the market.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls here if you have a question for Melody at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We find that the housing sales are down, not only here in California, but all across the nation. It's taking longer and longer to sell homes. There are a lot, of course, major developments that people are walking away from. People have put down deposits on condominiums, and they're walking away from the deposits. Their houses, they can't make the payments. They're simply walking away from the houses. And of course, this is why we have this problem with the collateralized debt obligations. These are mortgages bundled together, and they're non-performing mortgages. And then what's going to happen to the financial institutions that owns the houses? Of course, they're going to have to dump them at whatever price they can get. And so certainly what's happening back there in Pennsylvania, where you are, is the... Are you feeling the strains on the economy there, as they're feeling so many places in the nation?
Well, I think we see it a little bit, but not where I'm at here in Central. They're continuing to build. They're continuing to houses. They go on the market. Perhaps they're on the market maybe 3 months longer. I certainly don't see, you know, too much of a decline in the prices of homes. I'm sure they've come down a little bit, but you know, people out there are stubborn when they go to sell their homes, and you have real estate agents who are looking to make their commissions, telling these people that they're worth, that these homes are worth a lot more than what they really are, and so they budge, and perhaps they got themselves in a financial situation, so they really can't come down much in their homes anyway. So this area took a pretty big hit in jobs. Oh, probably 2 years ago, we saw a lot of people losing their jobs, a lot of the factories moving out, moving to China. We had a Corning plant here in State College, and they left. But we, you know, as usual, those good-paying jobs are replaced with retail.
Well, okay, the thing is, you live in a university town, don't you, or a college
town? Yes, I do, yeah.
And, of course, you know, the universities and colleges, especially if they either have a large endowment or are financed by government, they have unlimited money,
mm-hmm.
as long as the state has unlimited money.
Right.
Where they get into trouble is when of course, the people either will not pay their taxes or aren't able to pay their taxes, and the income of the state begins to go down.
Yep.
I live in California, where, of course, Governor Schwarzenegger has been spending money like it was going out of style. He actually got through $40 billion in bond issues last fall, so that we got all this free money. It doesn't cost us a cent. It's all in bonds. And, of course, then there's going to be a lot of business coming out of those bonds, certainly construction, things of that sort. And he's going to try to do the same thing again this year. But people never stop and say, well, but where does the money come from? It's going to have to be paid back sooner or later with interest, because that's what the way that the bond market works. And then what happens is more and more people begin moving out of the state or lose their jobs and don't have the income. And they're figuring there's going to be a major shortfall financially in California next year, and yet they're still spending money like it was going out of style. And I'm very much afraid that in a year or two, many of our states and municipalities that have certainly guaranteed massive pensions and welfare benefits to their employees, have been, political pressure has been put on them, are suddenly going to find that they don't have the money for making the welfare payments and the pension and retirement benefits to the employees. And then what happens? We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Melody Cedarstrom. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, Melody, tell me, did you hear what they actually agreed to as far as the General Motors strike was concerned? We did hear that the union had agreed to pick up the health and pension benefits for the retired employees. I don't know how much they received. The packet was supposed to be for $50 billion, and General Motors was trying to unload it for $30 or $35 billion. Do you know what happened?
No, I couldn't tell you right now. What I do know that I thought was interesting is when they actually had to buy their way, though, to get it done, because I believe each those that vote on it got a $3,000, which to me, for something so significant, I don't know how many people are involved, But, you know, they bought their votes by giving each one a bonus of $3,000. So when it went to vote, and I guess it still takes a little bit of time until it actually gets voted on and approved and so forth. So by no means is a done deal. But the key thing that they were holding out for was to keep the plants open, keep the factories open. And I guess they agreed to do it for 4 years until the end of this contract, but, you know, I don't know how that will help them, and I don't know how, you know, I would think that they wouldn't have any problem reneging on that end. I don't know if they can do that, but I guess it would help the benefits. The program somehow went into some sort of a trust, I believe, so it should be there for them, and they won't be able to rob the pension fund and use those funds for other things. So it will be protected for the employees. So I guess they did fare well there. But the key thing they were holding out was to keep the plants open.
Well, of course, the thing that really intrigues me is that now, of course, the union bosses are going to have their grubby little hands on that $30 or $35 billion. And we know certainly what's happened with other unions. When the union bosses have had access to that, the tremendous amounts of money that was supposedly there for the benefit of the workers, and suddenly it just began to disappear into large trusts and mammoth salaries for the union bosses and for the people they appointed to invest that money. So it'll be very interesting to see how much the employees, the 70, I think they're about at least 100,000 retired General Motors employees. I wonder, how much money they're eventually going to get down the line and how wisely that money will be invested. So under any circumstances, it certainly is going to give General Motors the possibility for a new lease on life. Let's hope so, although I think General Motors really plans as rapid as they can to move their production facilities out of the United States, certainly into Mexico and into China.
I think so too, they took the funds away so GM couldn't get to them, you know, so they couldn't rob them. But you're right, now the union bosses can. So, you know, and any of the rules that they make, any of the laws and rules and regulations, it's not for the people. You know, so for those who make the laws, those who have the wealth, those who can take and grab the wealth and basically just steal it from the people. And people have to remember that, and they become so accustomed of thinking that, you know, the government is there to help them and that these unions are there to help them and everybody's there to help them, but really they're only out there really to not so much of a benefit for them after all. But when you were talking about the states and the problems that they're in with the real estates and everything, and as long as the money keeps flowing, I've had several comments how property taxes are increasing. They're doubling. I've even had a few people tell me they actually tripled. And so property taxes is a way in which they do replenish their funds and keep the money flowing. They just take it from the properties, and they're going to keep going higher and higher. And I'm not so sure if it was Clinton, but we pay anywhere with all our taxes and everything, we pay what, 50, 55, maybe 60% of our wages go to taxes. And I believe it was him that said it'll be just a matter of time until we're paying 80%.
Well, of course, when you find that you get the taxes too high, two things happen. One, either people quit working, or they cheat on their taxes. I mean, that's just the way it's always been.
Yep.
I'll never forget going through some of those great mansions down along the Mississippi that were built at the time of the Civil War. And, of course, they had all their stairways were on the outside of the house, because if you had a stairway inside the house, why, they charged you more taxes. There were no closets in any of the rooms. They all had that big built-in facilities, but there were no closets because they taxed her for the closets, so people didn't have closets. And that's the way it was at the time of the Civil War, and it is still today. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We were simply talking about taxes. You remember back at the time of when Jesus was living in Nazareth and then traveling throughout the Holy Land. But, of course, the most detested people at that time were the tax collectors. And nothing has much changed since that time. I mean, people have always objected to paying taxes. They did at the time when our Lord was here. They do today because taxes, the average individual knows, are simply used many times as a vehicle of funneling money from the working class to the bureaucratic class, who have a special privileges. They get higher salaries. They get better pensions. They get better health care payments than us common people who pay their salaries. And, of course, it was Cicero who said, you know, before Christ was born, about 25 years B.C., the great Roman senator said, the budget should be balanced. Certainly foreign interventions should be limited. The arrogance of the bureaucrats should be tempered, and spending for foreign countries should be limited, else Rome will go bankrupt. Well, that was, of course, over 2,000 years ago, and Cicero was exactly right. And he was poisoned for telling the truth, but his words are simply resonant today. The same things are going on today. Nothing has changed. It's like deja vu all over again. Well, Melody, certainly as we look and see the economy, of course, we keep hearing that everything is fine. Certainly, I believe that what manufacturing we still have in this country is still functioning fairly well, but the housing market, which makes up almost 25% of our gross national product, I'm speaking now of home construction, I believe this is really cut back considerably. I don't know about your area or my area, but I do know that in many parts of the country, especially those parts of the country where certainly the housing market was expanding so rapidly, places like Phoenix and Miami and Las Vegas, why, of course, things have really slowed down. And with that, of course, an awful lot of the illegal immigrants have returned home. But the American workers who are working in the home building industry, many of them, of course, have lost their jobs and had to cut back considerably. And certainly if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But as you begin to cut back on the housing industry, making up 25% of the gross domestic product, I think this is going to have a tremendous impact on what's going on in America. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan Melody. Would you like to get your webpage and your telephone number out there? And once again, if you're out there listening audience, you have a question or comment, the number 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And let's get your website, telephone number, and how people can get in touch with you if they'd like to.
Well, they can call me on telephone number 1-800-375-4188. That is 1-800-375-4188. And the website is discountgoldandsilvertrading.net, discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. And if you would like to email me, you can do that. Questions about your gold and silver portfolios, discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com, discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com. And I encourage people to take inventories of what you're holding. Because I know oftentimes I've reviewed some gold and silver portfolios. I'm not an advocate of trading out or trading your coins just to do it. But there's a lot of programs and a lot of coins many times that are offered for specials, and they buy this, buy that, and it seems like these portfolios are just a hodgepodge of products. And yes, you have gold. But I believe sometimes you can tweak a portfolio, readjust it in a manner to maybe trading some out and making your better a little more sensible, going with the theme of 80% gold and 20% silver. So, you know, take inventories. You can call me and give me what you're holding, or email me what you're holding, or you want to jot it down and send me a note, you can do that also. So, now's the time to do it. People are waiting for a pullback in gold. I don't think we're going to have it. We're sort of building a base here at the 734 level, and there were a lot of predictions that we'd fall back to maybe 715, but with the fall of the dollar, and it seems that like it wants to break 78, but it is staying right above it, so I think we're at some key levels, and I have a feeling we might go forward, but everybody is waiting to see what's going to happen, but I think it's going to go upward.
I mean, you think that the value of gold and silver are going to go up and the value of the dollar is going to fall.
That's correct.
And, of course, this is actually what we would anticipate. We would anticipate the dollar is going to continue to fall. Why? Why? Because we're the largest debtor nation in the world today. And, of course, the strength of our currency is determined by certainly our foreign deficit. And we are running a foreign deficit this year in the neighborhood of between $800 and $900 billion, almost $1 trillion foreign deficit. This is massive. No nation has ever run deficits like this. Now, that is different than the federal budget deficit, which is, they tell us it's going to be about, $240 billion today, but they're simply lying. As they always do. They're stealing all the money that comes in from Social Security and all the money that comes from Medicare, which is supposedly going into a lockbox where it can be then given to the people when they retire or Medicare needs the money. But there's no money there. They simply put an IOU in and they use that as an asset. What madness is this? And the average individual does not understand that for years they've been lying to us, telling us there was a Social Security and a Medicare trust fund that was absolutely solvent. Well, of course, it's as solvent as an IOU from the United States government. But where is the United States government going to pay off the IOU? The government has no money other than what it takes from us by force through taxation. What it can borrow from future generations, which is done so well with over $48 trillion in real deficits here, in real debt here in the United States, and then of course, what it can actually print by simply printing money, but that's highly inflationary. And the big problem we have in America today is we have rampant inflation. The dollar is losing its value. People throughout the world do not believe the figures that they're publishing and telling the American people. They know that we have rapid inflation, and they know how rapidly the dollar is losing value. And that, of course, is why it's down almost to 78 now. We've got Larry calling from Wisconsin. Hi, Larry. How are you doing?
Oh, we're good.
Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do have a question. Are you aware, Annette, of the lawsuit, Annette, that Leo Wanta brought?
Right.
About the $4.5 trillion that was supposed to be released, Annette, to our economy.
Right.
I was wondering, Annette, whether or not, is there anything, Annette, that you have heard?
Well, I happen to have a much different approach to the entire story of the water fortune, and I believe that it is a fraud.
Oh.
I believe that I think I know who the money belongs to, and I have an idea where the money is. I do not know when it's going to be released, but when we have the permission of the people, I would certainly believe with all my heart that they're telling the truth, that there is the money, but that the story that is being publicly put out just is not true.
Mm.
All right?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, fine. But, Larry, one of these days I hope I will have the full story and I can even bring the people on who actually the money that actually belongs to. It's an amazing story. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye and God bless.
Yep, bye-bye.
And I'll tell you, when you know a secret, why there's such a tendency to want to tell it, but you do not do that because if you do, why, of course, this is a matter of honor and integrity. So again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you.
Any idea when you'll be able to release that information in the near future or further?
I really can't tell you. I've been hoping against hope any time, but I will be able to tell you a better idea in a little over a month from now. But I can't even tell you why a month from now is going to be important. But anyway, it's sort of an exciting thing. And for our people out there who do not know, there's a man named Leo Water. He claims to have been an ambassador that was appointed by Ronald Reagan to supervise this $4.some trillion that already belonged to the United States and is being secreted away in foreign banks, and one day it will be released and, of course, will be used to help to pay off the American debt. Well, it's going to be fascinating when the whole story comes out, because the story, at least as I have been told by people I trust, is entirely different than the story that most people have heard. Anyway, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have a question about what's happening to our economy, because, of course, as the dollar falls, of course, the value of people's savings is effectively destroyed. Now, that you're not aware of this, because certainly your food doesn't cost any more than when you go to the store, but if you were to go overseas, to go to Europe or elsewhere, you'd find just how devastated the dollar's been. Certainly we're told that the value of the Canadian dollar is rising dramatically, and that's really not true. The value of the American dollar is falling dramatically, and that's why it is it is going down in relationship to the Canadian dollar, and it's all how you frame the statement at all. People say, oh, the Canadian dollar is rising. No, the American dollar is falling, and that makes a great deal of difference.
Well, you know, Israel doesn't want our money. Egypt doesn't want our money. You know, they don't want to be paid, and, you know, I just assume not pay them at all, but, I still don't know why we are, but, the Saudis, they don't want our money. They want, Israel and Egypt want to be paid in euros for what we give them, and it is amazing how it's a change that we're seeing and being announced and reported, and it's like the Washington doesn't seem to. I always saw some sort of support where they wanted to hold the dollar, but it doesn't seem that that's important anymore, and it's like there's just no concern.
Well, I think what we're seeing is that Russia now is selling their oil either in euros or in rubles. In other words, they are using their own currency as a basis for selling their product. And we know that Dubai was turning away from the American dollar and was going to get into euros because they wanted a stable means of exchange. We know that Iran has turned away from the dollar. We know that Venezuela has turned away from the dollar. But if this were to happen simply on a larger scale, why, the dollar would lose its reserve status, and I rather think that within a year or 2 years at the most, the dollar will cease to be the reserve currency of the world, and that will have a disastrous effect, because other countries are holding between 2.5 and 3 trillion American dollars as reserves. If they ever stop holding those dollars as reserves, and they do that now because that, of course, is how they're able to, to buy oil. But if they could buy oil with euros or with rubles or with other currencies, then they wouldn't be holding the dollar and losing value. And they have lost almost 40% of their value over the last 3 years. And why would you want to hold a currency that's losing its value rapidly? And that is about to enter even another larger war that could have catastrophic results. So I really believe that if we do, the dollar ceases to be the reserve currency of the world, and those $3 trillion begin to flood back into our economy, it is going to have disastrous results. What are your thoughts on that, Melody?
Well, I agree, too. And today, I forgot to mention earlier, is oil today. Oil was up $2.50. It's up over 3%. At 82.88, and I mean that's just an incredible jump in the oil prices, and that was due to the, decline in crude inventories, and again the possible confrontation with Iran, as we know, Iran came out and said that the nuclear issue is closed. So, again, the background of what we don't know truly what's going on. So, you know, when we talk about the decline of the dollar and how all these countries used to buy their oil in dollars, it just shows a breaking down of the global system that once was.
Okay, we've got Peter calling from Salinas. Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Good evening. What a great program. I would like to interject just a small amount of humor, if I might.
Go right ahead.
This is a quote from President Bush regarding the handling of national spending. Quote, I would say that the record, our fiscal record, is admirable and good, end quote. Try not to laugh too hard.
Right. Well, thanks very much, Peter.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, sometimes the president does make misstatements and gets his wording a little confused.
Well, he is on drugs, right?
Well, I don't know what he's on, but I think it is an embarrassment when the most powerful man
really
in the world
is.
Today really cannot many times carry out an intelligent conversation or make intelligent remarks.
That is very true.
Anyway, God bless and thanks very much,
Thank
Peter.
You.
All right, fine. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And of course, we're Sydney at a crossroads in the history of our country. If, Sydney, we go to war with Iran, if there is no outcry from the religious people in this country, in other words, they can justify going over there and killing hundreds of thousands of more people in the name of, oh, well, my goodness, Iran might someday have nuclear weapons. They deny they're trying to build them. I said that we did actually give the whole nuclear program to the Iranians back during the Ford administration and encouraged them to go into the development of nuclear power. But, and I think people have to understand, our attack on Iran has nothing to do with nuclear weapons. I believe there is a master plan. I believe there's a cosmic timetable. I believe there is an organized effort to bring about the class of civilizations that was written about by the Council on Foreign Relations member Samuel Huntington in a classic book, and then, of course, reiterated in an article that he wrote for Foreign Affairs magazine. And I suggest that people read it and read what he said about what will happen if we get into a war with the Muslim world and we try to force the Muslims to adhere to our sense of values. Because they have a different sense of values. They believe in morality. They believe that you should have a society without taxation. They believe, of course, that America and our society is a depraved society that has embraced satanic ideas. And the President Ahmadinejad has said we should turn away from our licentious lifestyle. Is there any truth to any of the things that they say? Is this the America that you were raised in 20, 30, 40 years ago? Have we turned our back on God? Well, I think that these are all questions that we should ask, and of course I believe that we should actually look and see what's happening and realize that there is always a spiritual component to everything. And I believe, of course, that, that we are really involved in a spiritual battle, not a political battle, not a cultural battle, not an ideological battle. So, you know, certainly everything suggests that, somewhere between 30 and 60 days while we'll be involved in a war with Iran. I don't know when it's coming. Certainly, I only know what I learned from people who have connections at the highest levels of government, and my impression is it's only a matter of time. Let's hope and pray I'm wrong. Melody, do you have a parting thought for our listeners?
Well, things can change very rapidly. We've been sort of just blessed because this has been drawn out for so long. And I think change, we're in a time where I think change can happen very rapidly. It can happen overnight. We'll wake up one morning and the world will be different. Our lifestyles will be different. I don't know when that will be. It could be, you know, tomorrow. It could be next month. It could be next year. But I do believe it will happen very quickly. So, folks, if you're planning on repositioning your investments, don't wait. You can't time the markets. If you're looking to get into gold and silver, you can't time the market. If you think that gold might be going down and doing a little bit of a pullback, you can do some cost averaging. And so, but the key thing is don't wait. Take an inventory of what you have. You should be carrying a minimum of 30 to 50% of hard assets in gold and silver.
Melody, before we go on, let's give your telephone number one more time and your website.
1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
And your webpage is?
DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net. DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net.
And I guess it's been Melody Cederstrom, and we hope you've enjoyed our conversation with her. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Melody, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, I'll just recap. Make sure you have 30-50% minimum of your hard assets in gold and silver. And of that, 80% should be gold, 20% should be silver. And I've been, you know, you hear a lot of comments about, you know, buy silver, buy silver, buy silver. It's a great investment, but folks, you got to still remember it's an industrial metal. And if you believe that industry is going to slow, you have to ask yourself where the decline in demand will offset the inventory. So that's where the volatility is created. I think you'll see silver convert more to a monetary metal as we go along, but silver has always been volatile. The central banks and people, when they turn to a safe haven, it is not to silver, it is to gold. So you have to remember that we're having a currency situation, so you want a precious metal that is a currency, and that's why you want to be heavier in gold than silver. And you can diversify amongst the metals, but take a look at what you currently have. And if you're just getting into the market, you know, I believe in being diversified and offsetting. And I look at the precious metals as basic. I stick to fundamentals. I stick to building a foundation. Then if you want to speculate a little bit and try different things, but first you want to build your foundation of gold and silver. And we'd love to do that, and all you have to do is give us a call.
All right, fine. Well, we appreciate having you with us, Melody, and I really think that people are going to have to change the entire way that they're thinking about things. The world that we've known for the past 40 or 50 years doesn't exist anymore.
No.
The dollar, which was since the end of the Second World War, the strongest currency in the world, the reserve currency in the world, the currency that gave us tremendous advantages over other nations, has gradually been losing value. I can remember when you could get 4 marks to the dollar, you could get a pound for a dollar, but the dollar has been gradually losing its value. And, of course, recently it's been rapidly losing its value. And certainly the stability of a nation is dependent upon the stability of the currency. Destroy the stability of the currency. Destroy the savings of the people. Disillusion the people. And, of course, there's tremendous instability within society. And I can see the time coming very soon where, of course, many of our senior citizens, like the citizens in Europe today, when they converted the German mark and the Austrian shilling into euros, and those people became impoverished because they lost half the value of this currency, I fear the same thing will happen here. Well, this is Dr. Stan Melody. Thanks very much for being with us. We'll look forward to having you with us again next month.
Thank you, sir.
Good night. And God bless. And, of course, that was Melody Cederstrom. Always a pleasure to have. If you'd like, of course, to have an opportunity to learn more about what we're talking about, let me suggest my last two newsletters there. The July one is up on the website. The August one will be going up very soon, and I'm just completing my September newsletter. I learn a great deal whenever I write a newsletter. And so if you'd like to get us to get the, some of the material we've written on finance, we have a pamphlet called The History of Money, which we think is important. We have a talk called Financial Tsunami. It's available in either DVD or VHS, but there's a syllabus that goes with that. And, of course, we think that is very, very important. And there, of course, you'll see many of the information on the Federal Reserve statistics. You'll find out what happened to America's gold from the government's own statistics. So certainly the talk on the financial tsunami, and then, of course, the syllabus goes with that. To really understand what is taking place, we suggest the book The Creature from Jekyll Island, Anthony Sutton's great book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, and, of course, the book Fiat Money, Inflation in France, along with my pamphlet entitled The History of Money and my talk on the financial tsunami. And if you get and read these, of course, you'll know more than most college professors, and you'll have at least some idea what you should be doing today to protect yourself and what you have worked for all of your life, because I fear that before this is over, an awful lot of good people are going to lose everything that they've worked their entire life for. And that is what always happens when a financial situation falls into disrepair, when a nation turns against sound economic principles. And there's no instance in all history where a nation has been on a fiat money system, where that fiat money system has not eventually collapsed. And now is the time when ours is collapsing. Well, this is the time we need to remind our listeners that we are going to be having an all-day seminar on the 28th of October, and certainly it's going to be at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. You're going to need a reservation if you can come. And if you're coming from elsewhere, you've only got another day to actually tie up a hotel room at a decreased price. Otherwise, you're on your own. But tomorrow, why is the last day? So if you're going to come from a distance, give us a call tonight or tomorrow, and we'll give you the telephone number on the hotel where we reserved a block of rooms. That's the Sea Cliff Inn, adjacent to the beach there. And then, of course, very, very close to the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. And then, of course, we hope that if you can come, that you'll bring your friends. I think you'll find a great lineup. The program will start in the morning and go until quite late in the evening, about 5:30. And we're looking forward to seeing as many of you as possible. Then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there will want to get our book on the Brotherhood of Darkness, to begin to understand the spiritual implications of what's going on, that you'll want to, of course, get my talk on the forbidden secret, and the syllabus goes with that, that you'll want to get the award-winning DVDs made by Chris Pinto, The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, and Riddles in Stone, and Millennium 1, or Megiddo 1 and Megiddo 2. We also have a video, and I believe it's in DVD form as well, with Chris Pinto, where he talks about the Atlantis connection. And you might wonder what Atlantis has to do with anything. It has everything to do with it. Why? Because there are many people within the secret societies who have always felt that America would be the new Atlantis, would lead the world into the new world order, the new world religion. We also have a forum CD or tape set and a DVD with Constance Cumby, and of course the DVD is called Emerging. So remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.